Okay, so the first thing I should do, I guess, is acknowledge my co-authors, Bob Cantor from SUNY Upstate Medical University. He's a critical care physician that runs the pediatric ICU up there. And Joe Terza, who's a health economist at the University of North Carolina at Greensboro. I don't have any disclosures to make. I don't have any financial vested interest in this of any kind. So what I want to talk about today is how we would go about measuring quality of care, broadly speaking, at what we'll call comprehensive pediatric hospitals relative to other general kind of ordinary hospitals. And one of the reasons this is important is because there's a push on to regionalize pediatric hospital care. This is something that's been advocated by the American Academy of Pediatrics, the American College of Critical Care Medicine, among others. And by regionalization, we mean a process whereby high-risk patients are seen at regional comprehensive pediatric hospitals. I'll be more specific in a minute about what I mean by a pediatric hospital, but they're pretty much what you think. They're the big regional hospitals that have lots of high-tech services and, you know, everything like that. Whereas less severely ill patients would then be seen closer to home at kind of community hospitals, regular hospitals. As far as we're aware, the existing evidence, though, that this is actually beneficial in terms of outcomes is fairly scant and tends to be limited to specific areas, specific services, things like cardiac surgery, ICU care. And to the best of our knowledge, there's not any evidence about that extends to inpatient care, generally speaking. So in terms of defining a pediatric hospital, my co-author Bob actually has proposed a definition that was published and I guess has gained some acceptance in some quarters. So a hospital in our data set is going to be one, a pediatric hospital in our data set, is one that's in the top decile statewide, both for volume and for the diversity of disorders, the kind of the heterogeneity in medical conditions that are treated there, as well as one that has a pediatric residency program. So we're using data from New York State, and to give you a better feel for who these hospitals are and how stringent the definition is, there are 241 hospitals in the state of New York. There are 11 that meet all three of these criteria for our study period. And as I alluded to earlier, they really are kind of the usual suspects. So they're the big hospitals in New York City, Columbia Presbyterian, Mount Sinai, Cornell Medical Center, and there's a smattering of hospitals that are in Long Island and up in Westchester. And then up through upstate New York, you tend to have one big comprehensive pediatric hospital in each of Albany, Syracuse, Rochester, and Buffalo, 11 in total. So these really are, in a sense, I think the good hospitals, and that's something important to keep in mind. This paper is in part kind of a methodological exercise. It's one where we're really interested in quantifying the size of the effect here. I think it should be pretty clear that all other things held constant, especially for high-risk patients, these are probably better hospitals to take your kids than your local community hospital, especially if they're at high risk, or if they're very seriously ill. And being seriously ill is actually the problem we have to confront in an empirical exercise like that. There's something that's well known, any of you that are clinicians are probably familiar with this, known as case mix bias. And this is just the propensity of the better hospitals, the 11 I listed, to attract patients that are either more severely ill to begin with or perhaps more complicated to treat because of various comorbidities or other kind of complexities involved in their case. A standard approach for dealing with this problem is something known as risk adjustment. So risk adjustment is essentially a way of using observable characteristics of the patients, including some of their medical characteristics, to try to adjust for the probability of an adverse outcome like mortality, which is the outcome we're going to be looking at. And I think, you know, risk adjustment is something that's very popular. I'm going to take a fairly pessimistic view about it. I think going in, before I did this study, I had a fairly pessimistic view of risk adjustment because most of the evidence I've seen suggests that it works best under two conditions which are hard to meet in practice in a lot of studies. First of all, it works best when you confine it to fairly narrow conditions. So if you look at things like elderly folks with pneumonia or heart attacks or things like that, it's very difficult to fully risk adjust when you're looking at outcomes across hospitals for the full range of different medical conditions that people present with. That makes it more difficult. And also, the risk adjustment works best when it's done using very detailed clinical information, the kind of information you can glean from looking at somebody's medical record or maybe even at their chart. And I've seen some studies that have done that. That's very, very costly to assemble data. data like that. Most of the data that have been used to look at hospital quality have used these state discharge databases, which is what we use here, and that level of detail is just not available in those data sets. And finally, of course, it may be possible that even under the best of circumstances, there's just residual differences in patient severity that you just can't fully account for. So an alternate solution that's very popular among economists, I don't know if it's caught on more broadly, is a statistical methodology known as instrumental variables estimation. And the goal of instrumental variables estimation is to try to find something, a variable, that acts as a pseudo-randomizing device. So if you think about the way randomization works, the two key features of randomization that make it the gold standard for evaluating anything is that randomization determines how people are sorted into treatment versus control groups. But the other key feature is that randomization does not exert any independent influence on the outcome you're studying. So if you could find a data like that, if you could find a variable like that in real-world data, then you could do something that, while not as good as randomization, not as pure or as clean, at least gets rid of some of this case mix problem. The standard variable that people use in the literature and looking at hospital quality is something known as differential distance. So differential distance is the distance from each patient's home to the nearest, in our case, pediatric hospital, minus the distance from each patient's home to the nearest hospital of any type. And to further kind of buttress our empirical strategy here, we're also going to restrict comparisons to patients who reside in the same county. There are about 60 counties in New York State. Restricting attention to patients who reside in the same county solves or at least minimizes a couple of problems. One is, generally speaking, you're not conflating urban and rural differences as much when you look at people that live in the same county. You're not comparing, in New York State, this is very important, you're not comparing Manhattan to somebody who lives up in the Adirondack Mountains. You're only comparing people in Manhattan to other people in Manhattan. And the other thing is that it minimizes any effect of absolute distance, which is not our instrument, but our differential distance instrument may, in some cases, be somewhat correlated with absolute distance, which is obviously an important independent indicator of mortality risk for time-sensitive emergencies, things like trauma or heart attacks or things like that. Now, the assumption I described earlier is not something you can test directly, but there are some checks available. So if you think about true randomization, one thing that would be true if you actually randomize patients across hospitals is that controlling for observable patient characteristics or covariates wouldn't really affect the estimates after you randomized. And so that's a little heuristic check that we can apply in this setting as well. And finally, our instrument itself, differential distance, should be roughly the same for patients based upon observable measures of their severity, high versus low risk patients. Those are two things we can take a quick look at. So what we're going to do is we're going to compare mortality rates. That's our crude measure of quality. I recognize that it's not a general measure of quality, but it doesn't suffer from too much measurement error, so it does have one advantage. And we're going to use three different specifications. One where we're going to control only for patient demographics, just basic demographic information. Then we're going to add in a full set of controls for DRGs. And we're going to control for these in a very flexible way by entering in a separate indicator for every single DRG that's available in our discharge data, which is about 400 different DRGs. So this is a very flexible type of risk adjustment, and that's one of the reasons I'm a little bit pessimistic about risk adjustment when you see the results. And then finally, doing both of those things listed under 1 and 2 in conjunction with using this differential distance instrument. There's nothing mutually exclusive about these methodologies. You control for as much as you can, and in addition, you try to pseudo-randomize. And we're going to look at two different groups of patients, all patients in a high-risk subgroup. Those are children that have chronic conditions of various sorts, severe organ dysfunction, trauma, and infants less than 1 year old. Our sample comes from the New York State SPARCS, which is the New York State discharge database for the years 96 to 2002. It's a complete census of all inpatients. We're looking at ages 0 to 14, excluding neonates for that period. This actually gives us a nice size sample. We end up with data on about 900,000 children in total and 355,000 that are in that high-risk subgroup I described. To give you a flavor for the data, fortunately, inpatient mortality rates for children are quite low, only about 3.5 per thousand overall and 7.8 per thousand for our high-risk subgroup. And across all of the hospitals in our sample, about 27% of patients, of all patients, and 34% of the high-risk patients go to these comprehensive pediatric hospitals. In the interest of time, I'm not going to talk through these in any great detail. These are the covariates we include. Notice that we're going to have indicators for counties, year, and all of the ERGs in that specification, at least. I'm not sure why this font is messed up. It didn't look like that before, but in any event, hopefully everybody can read it fine. So anyway, here are the results for all patients. If you control only for patient demographics, what you find is that the pediatric hospitals actually look worse than all the other hospitals. And most of the other hospitals are community hospitals, so this is somewhat counterintuitive. You find an excess mortality rate of about almost 8 deaths per 1,000 hospitalizations among those 11 high-quality hospitals I listed earlier. If you add in the controls for DRGs, it attenuates this effect, but you still find a statistically significant mortality disadvantage for the comprehensive pediatric hospitals to the tune of about 3 deaths per 1,000. If in addition to those things you use this instrumental variables approach, then the sign flips and you actually find a mortality advantage, meaning lower mortality at the pediatric hospitals equal to about 4.5 deaths per 1,000. Hospitalizations. As far as those checks goes, those checks go, I should say, if you omit the covariates, you find a reduction in mortality at the pediatric hospitals about 4 deaths per 1,000. Going back, that's pretty similar to the 4.7 we found before. It's not perfect, but it's certainly within the ballpark. And finally, as you can see, differential distance, our instrument, does not differ appreciably across the patients that are in the high risk and the low risk categories based on their clinical conditions. Only about a quarter of a mile difference on average, and there's quite a broad range of distances. So for the high risk patients, we see exactly the same pattern of results, just larger effect sizes. Again, excess mortality at the pediatric hospitals, when you use the control variables, now there are larger effects. When you use instrumental variables, you find a reduction, a lower mortality rate at pediatric hospitals to the tune of about 14 deaths per 1,000 hospitalizations. And again, the check without the covariates leads to a similar sized effect. So the conclusions are about what you'd expect here, I think. We conclude that pediatric hospitals do care for sicker patients than other types of hospitals, and that at least some of the difference is not anything that we can observe or control for directly, using administrative data. I don't know about more detailed clinical data, but that in the end, pediatric hospitals do succeed in providing a higher quality care, and especially as you would expect for the more severely ill patients. As far as implications go, I wrote a few down on the slide. I think the thing that Bob Cantor would want me to convey to you is that he's of the impression that there are a fair number of children in upstate New York that would actually benefit significantly from being referred to a comprehensive pediatric hospital that are when those referrals are actually withheld and the children are instead seen at community hospitals, smaller hospitals, because of reimbursement incentives. And so maybe there's a role for policymakers here to try to better align the incentives for appropriate triage, especially for these higher risk children.